The age of farmers is growing around the world. I think the average age of farmers in the United States is almost 60. It's the same in China. And every year, millions of people leave the countryside for the city. And by the year 2030, I think 70% of the world's population will live in cities.
What does that tell us about the ability of us to feed the world?
Well, I think that the lifestyle of farming, even in our own country, is becoming much harder way to support your family. You have a climate that's tipping out of your favor. Farmers around the world, whether it's a cocoa farmer in Ivory Coast or an apple farmer in China, are scratching their heads about the changing climate and trying to figure out what they need to do to combat that. So that's part of the problem. And you also have an economy that's tipping out of their favor as well. So if you look at coffee, which is one of the largest traded foods in the world. And so in, what year was it? 1991, the global coffee market was worth about $30 billion, and producing countries kept 40% of it. Today it's worth $70 billion, and producing countries only keep 10% of it. So that's even a smaller number. They're making less all the time, and it's the same for the American farmer too. So since 1984, the real price of a basket of food has gone up only like 3%, but the cut to American farmer has gone down 35%. So it's just becoming harder to make a living as a farmer. There's a billion farmers on the planet, and 60% of them live in poverty. Right?
And who is keeping the extra then?
Who is keeping the extra? Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's going to the transportation companies. It's going to larger companies all the time. So if you look at, I live in Indiana. My grandfather grew up on a farm. My father grew up on a farm, and we kind of got out of it. But, you know, the farmers sell their farm to their neighbors, and their neighbor starts buying up other people's farms. So suddenly there was an area where there was, you know, five or six family farms, and now there's one family farm because the economy of scale is how you can make a living as a farmer. You have to be a lot larger farmer.
Is the global food web sustainable with transportation costs the way they are now?
Well, I mean, the price of labor is a lot cheaper other places, and the environmental regulations are less. So there are chemicals that we have banned in the United States that we used to use in production of our food that now are used on food produced in other countries that are then shipped to us, right? So it's like those can be used in your land to pollute your rivers, but not on ours. And we still benefit from those foods from that cheaper labor. So for instance, chocolate. You know, everybody loves chocolate. 2/3 of the world's chocolate comes from Ivory Coast. When I was in Ivory Coast, I met a young man from a neighboring country of Ghana named Solo, who by all definitions and by his reality is a slave. Asked to leave the farm, wasn't allowed to leave, been there for 4 months, hadn't been paid anything. He might get paid $300 at the end of that year, right? It's hard to compete with that type of labor. Now, granted, we're not going to grow cacao in Indiana by any means. We're not going to grow it in Illinois. But yeah, it's hard to compete with the price of labor and then the lack of environmental regulations in certain places.
We hear about conflict diamonds, but we never hear about conflict vanilla. And yet there is such a thing. You're arguing that there are other externalized costs that we also ought to be paying attention to. And yet it's hard to do that when costs are so much cheaper for these things if they are used by exploitative labor.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to ask people to start paying more for chocolate, right? But then so many of us, when we see and we hear about the lives of the people who we're connected with every single day, from the clothes that we wear to the food that we eat. In the last year, last 10 years, we've doubled the amount of food that we import to our nation. So we're connected with more and more solos around the world every single day. And when we come face to face with that reality, we become aware of it, then we start to ask these more difficult questions. Like, should we be paying more for chocolate? Should we be consuming less? Should we be consuming in a different way? And I think those are really important questions that we all wrestle with when we live in a world where there is such inequality.
How do you propose making that part of the culture, though, when price is very important to people and people's own resources are scarce?
Well, so if you actually look at coffee is in jeopardy of not being available widely for our consumption, right? Because of the state of the environment. coffee is having to grow higher and higher on hillsides. So we are going to pay a higher cost for coffee because of how we've treated the environment. In terms of cacao, you know, 2/3 comes from Ivory Coast. That in Ghana, it's 3/4. If you factor that in, there are farmers who are saying they make 1/3 of 1 penny for the amount of chocolate, cacao and a Hershey, like a chocolate bar, a milk chocolate bar, right? For example, like a Hershey milk chocolate bar. And they are choosing to go and grow rubber trees. They're saying, hey, forget growing these trees anymore. We're not making enough money. They are leaving. So now you have companies that are concerned that their resource is in jeopardy, and that might jeopardize that we can even have this type of cheap chocolate. So we can just continue to pay a small amount for things, and eventually it is going to cost more or not exist as well. So these are the things we have to wrestle with.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Kelsey Timmerman, a family consumer sciences presenter at the fall lecture series. He's the author of Where Am I Eating? You're also the author of Where Am I Wearing? What did you find in your trips to find out the source of people's clothes?
Yeah, so first off, this was not my intent to like write a book about clothes, right? So I graduated from college, and I was curious and wanted to travel and see how other people lived and have adventures and write about those adventures. And then I went to Honduras because I had a T-shirt that was made there. And I showed up at the factory wearing the shirt, asking if I could have a tour. And they're like, who are you? And like, why are you here? Like, all like really good questions. And then I waited inside the factory for the workers to be let out because I was not going to get a tour. And I met a young man that was my same age. His name was Amilcar. And we were both 25 years old at the time. And it became very awkward very fast. All of a sudden, I think for the first time in my life, I was kind of confronted with the privilege and opportunities in my own life. Here I was traveling like willy-nilly around the world. Here I met the guy who made the shirt I was wearing. And
what was his life like?
He grew up on a farm and moved on the outskirts of San Pedro Sula, Honduras. And shortly after I met him, he decided that job, that life was not enough for him and his family. So that he made the trip through, bought a bus ticket to Guatemala, the border of Mexico, hopped on top of a train, right? He, at one point, talks about walking in Mexico, and he literally walked his shoes off and then made it to the train where he wasn't like, one first class ticket. No, it's where you hang on the side of the train and climb top of the trains and traveled months through Mexico like that, escaping bandits and the federal police, and eventually made it into the United States. And now he supports his family in a way that he couldn't if he were actually there with them, right? So I think that says a lot. Many of the people I've met and Where Am I Wearing, I've kept in touch with over the past decade. And many of them are not working in garment workers anymore. These jobs are important for people, especially women. One of the best ways to lift people out of poverty is to educate and employ women, because they spend their money more responsibly than guys do, more likely to reinvest it in their families. So many people believe that the garment industry is like the first rung of the global economic ladder.
They are actually bootstrapping through starting on this in these essentially sweatshops.
Yeah, I mean it's. It's not as black and white as we would like it to be, right? If this is an opportunity or this is exploitation, right? Many of the people I've met and kept in touch with, their lives have not gotten better because they worked in a garment factory. Many of them have moved back to the villages and started families, and it's not as simple as we would like it to be. But these are opportunities that people leave the fields and go to the cities to work, and sometimes those opportunities literally crash around them, like we saw in Bangladesh. A few years ago when that factory collapsed and killed like 1,133 people. And, you know, some of those labels that were found in that factory there's a good chance that some of those labels are in my closet or some of those labels are in your listener's closet. We have to ask, like, is this okay to live in a world like this?
Does every country have to have the equivalent of New York's Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, though, that created laws for garment workers in the United States? Do other countries have to have that same thing?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's a really good argument that it's just one of the steps of development, right? That you have the garment factories, and you have labor wrongs happen in your country, and then wages go up and rights go up and people fight for those rights, and then better jobs move in. And I think that was the case for us. I think that was the case for South Korea, Singapore. You can point to those examples. I mean, those examples are kind of older examples, though. I think that business moves much faster today than it did in 1911 when the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire happened, right? So a company like Nike works with sources from like 50 to 90 countries. I can't remember the exact number. Like a lot of countries around the world and multiple factories within that country. So within a few clicks, I can move all of those orders from Bangladesh and take them to China. So I think business moves much faster now than it used to.
People like you who tell that story, or anti-sweatshop advocates who are more militant than explanatory about it, can they keep up with the rate at which the manufacturers shift the shelves around the globe and move the production?
Progress has been made. So, for example, if you look in Bangladesh, where that factory collapsed, the Workers' Rights Consortium has worked really hard and to make sure there was, I forget how many other factories identified that were just ripe for the collapsing, right? So they worked to inspect all those factories and get them up to code. So it's less likely now, because of their work, that factories will be collapsing. There'll be this giant disaster like they used to have. But for example, in Honduras, where the workers, by their own studies, have shown that they earn a poverty wage, what's considered a poverty wage in Honduras, the global economy has kind of talked and said that they are earning too much, that we can source from Nicaragua for cheaper. And those lives of the people who worked in that garment factory, including Amilcar's sister, haven't drastically improved because the garment industry has been there. So what we've seen is the garment industry has come in and it's moved before there was some great economic impact and, you know, it left and all of a sudden Apple moved in or something like that. Business moves much faster today.